Welcome to another edition of the podcast series brought to you by the Business Rescue Restructuring and Insolvency Team at Cliffdecker Hofmeyr. My name is Tobi Jordan and I head up the team at CDH. My colleagues in the insolvency world will be familiar with the term the Twilight Zone. This is used to describe a period of trading when a company has or is predicated to have insufficient cash to pay its debts as they fall due. After reading the recent judgment of Montic Dairy versus Mazars, I realized that it would also be possible for business rescue practitioners to find themselves in the Twilight Zone. This will refer to the period whilst they wait for a liquidation order to be granted, after a decision has been made to convert the business rescue proceedings to a liquidation. Today we are joined by a well-known liquidator and a business rescue practitioner to discuss the Mazars judgment. Please review us, rate us, and share wherever you want. Thank you.
Thanks, Tobi. The decision in this matter was handed down last Wednesday and has since caused much chatter within the insolvency sector. The court in this Mazars judgment was faced with the issue surrounding payments made to the business rescue practitioners after the commencement of liquidation proceedings, where Montic Dairy, which was previously undergoing business rescue, was subsequently placed into liquidation. The question the court had to grapple with was whether these payments constituted dispositions in terms of Section 3412 of the Old Companies Act, and whether these could be set aside as a result thereof. In considering these legal questions arising from the case, Lucinda Rurdy will be facilitating this discussion with our panelists.
Thanks, Jessica. We are pleased to welcome our two guest panelists to today's podcast, who will be discussing the Mazars judgment. We welcome Richard Pollock of Harvard Corporate Rescue Services, an insolvency practitioner and liquidator since 1991, a member of the South African Restructuring and Insolvency Practitioners Association, as well as Insol International, who has been involved in numerous high-profile and complex matters. We also welcome Christopher Ray, a restructuring professional at BDO, a practicing attorney who holds an experienced business rescue practitioner license from CIPC. Christopher specializes in business restructuring and business rescue, and he is actively involved in the restructuring and business rescue of multiple mining, construction, retail, and property companies in South Africa. Richard, I think we will start with you. In considering the court's findings that the payments were made after the establishment of the concursus, do you think the court erred in not finding that the payments were made at the commencement of the winding up process? Or is the court correct in its finding, which suggests that the concursus backdates to the commencement date of the winding up?
Thanks, Lucinda. I think it's always been accepted that the concursus is actually the day that the company is placed into liquidation and not the issue date of the application in terms of Section 348. It obviously refers to the 348 date as the commencement of the winding up, but it doesn't use the word concursus. So the concursus has always been understood to be the date upon which the company or the entity is placed into liquidation. And I think there is a distinction, quite simply because only a liquidator can deal with the property of the company once the insolvency regime has kicked in, and that would be kicking in on the concursus date, not the 348 or the Section 348 date. But that doesn't necessarily validate the transactions that happened between the 348 date and the court order date or the concursus date, and any disposition of property as set out in Section 341 is vulnerable. It's vulnerable, I think, not only in terms of Section 341.2, but also as a potential impeachable transaction in terms of the Insolvency Act. So my reading of the judgment is not to say that any disposition of property by the company after the 348 date is necessarily automatically void, but may be void unless the court orders it.
Thanks. Chris, against that answer, should the opinion be that the court was correct in backdating the concursus to the commencement date? What do you see are the practicalities thereof on the obligations, duties expected of a BRP, and of course the cost incurred by the BRP during that uncertain period?
Well, thank you, Lucinda. Thank you for including me in the conversation. I don't think it's often that a liquidator and a BRP agree on certain things, but what I do agree with Richard on is that the date of the concursus should be at the date of the order. Now, if we are going to, for purposes of the question, consider that the backdating of the concursus is at the commencement date, then it does create severe problems for a business rescue practitioner. And I think the best way for me to deal with this is to give you two practical examples. So let's consider that a BRP is appointed, and within days of his or her appointment, a liquidation application is issued. Now, we often see this happen because a shareholder, for example, may be disgruntled, and the business rescue practitioner obviously cannot control that situation. It is that shareholder's right to bring the liquidation application, but it brings about a situation where the practitioner still has an obligation to implement the business rescue process, to develop a plan, to hopefully have it adopted, and to continue to pay creditors that are post-commencement of that rescue. Now, you could have the audacious situation where the practitioner runs his or her matter for 2 years because it takes that long for the opposed matter to be heard, and all of a sudden you have a situation where everything that's been done in that rescue is subject to either being void or being unlawful. Now, I'm certain that Richard might say, well, they would have a claim in the liquidation from the free residue, for example, but I think, in my humble opinion, that's oversimplistic. I think another practical example where you may find yourself in serious trouble is that a practitioner may have already had his or her plan adopted. Now, we all know that the Companies Act requires of the company and the practitioner to implement that plan as adopted. Now, what if that plan includes payments to creditors? There may be an arrangement with a business rescue practitioner regarding his or her fees, which is now legislated in that business rescue plan. And subsequently, there is a liquidation of that company, and all of those transactions may be subject to being unlawful or voidable. Now, in my experience, especially in larger matters where you have mines, for example, you're not talking hundreds of thousands of rands of costs every month. You're talking 3 to 4 million rand, and I'm talking from experience on a particular matter that I'm involved with now. So how do you incur those types of costs, which may perpetuate for even 2 years at a time, and you find that all of those transactions may be set aside by a liquidator? For me, these are very serious problems, and problems that we've been dealing with as business rescue practitioners for some time.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Chris. It almost seems that from a interpretative perspective, the court hasn't taken into account the business-like approach when interpreting statutes when there's an issue like this.
I certainly agree with that, Lucinda.
Richard, coming back to you, this is also it's more a practical question than anything else. I mean, one can also ask that would the payment of the BRP's fees not in any event have a neutral effect on the concursus, irrespective of when the commencement date is, because the BRPs have a preferential claim in terms of Section 143. And it also touches a little bit on what Chris just said. So what's your view on that?
I think we also just need to be careful not to use this judgment to determine a whole different set of facts which may or may not occur in a matter. But the fact that there may ultimately be a distribution to a creditor doesn't validate the payment or authorize the payment pre-liquidation to that creditor. You know, the whole function of a liquidator in a winding up is to examine the claims that are submitted against the estate, and creditors can also have the right to interrogate and examine those claims and to deal with those claims according to the Insolvency Act and the ranking of distribution. And I don't think we can ever say that it's the business rescue's practitioners right to determine whether there is or isn't free residue in the estate, what costs may come up after the date of liquidation, what free residue may be available ultimately for payment to the business rescue practitioner, albeit that it is, let's call it a super preference claim. That's the job of the liquidator. You know, we've seen all too often that securities get challenged. You know, why can't the business rescue practitioner's claim get challenged if it's not in accordance with the tariff that was agreed with the company? So it may have ultimately a neutral effect to the practitioner if their claim is valid and in accordance with the fee arrangement that is in place. Then the only prejudice they will really suffer is a cash flow aspect. But I don't think it's for the business rescue practitioner to determine whether a claim will get paid when a liquidation application has been received and it's likely that that company is going to go into liquidation.
Yeah. So it's really the delaying effect that becomes the issue.
Yes, I mean, and I know we understand the business rescue practitioner's dilemma. Liquidators face a similar position where you're appointed as a liquidator in a company, a business rescue application gets launched. You know, we still have the statutory obligations and we can't just throw our hands up in the air and say, well, I'm not going to get paid, so I'm not going to do this. And unfortunately, liquidators are in a worse position because they don't have a super preference. But that's maybe me just having a little gripe, but that's about it.
No one can understand that. Chris, asking you now to look into a crystal ball, do you think there would have been a different outcome to this judgment if there was a separate counter application by the BRPs arguing on an application for a different interpretation of Section 341, especially if one takes into account the fact that the judge have mentioned the lack of a counter application?
Thanks, Lucinda. I think that the mere fact that the judge mentioned it obviously doesn't allude to the fact that it may have been granted. However, I think, you know, without repeating what Richard has said, the bringing of the account application would have to show, obviously, that it's not a disposition. And I still firmly believe that if we can deal specifically with when the concursus is in place, I think that would deal with this quite clearly. And for me, a counter application like that may have been successful on the grounds that, for example, some of those costs may have been in the ordinary course of business and therefore were not necessarily void. But one of my gripes is that there is a constant thought that practitioners' fees are in fact something that is not part of the ordinary course of a business's activity. And the reason for my gripe is that those fees are in terms of statute. And to Richard's point, I certainly don't condone fees where fees have been written over and above what they were entitled to in terms of the Act. In fact, I think that is something a liquidator should take up with a practitioner directly if there are overcharging or overreaching allegations regarding the fees. But the mere fact that a practitioner has been paid, even in this grey area, as you may call it, I don't think it should be anything other than the ordinary course of business. But that's perhaps just my opinion.
Well, I think that actually, thanks, Chris. That actually touches on the question I want to pose to Richard now as well, because Blackman, in his commentary on the Old Companies Act, acknowledges that Section 3412 can cause considerable hardship. And if one looks at what our courts have done in the past, and to mitigate against these harsh consequences, our courts have validated dispositions made during this period on the basis that the payment was made in good faith and the creditor concerned has since presentation of the winding up application helped to keep the company afloat. So the question really to you, Richard, is considering the fact that the business rescue practitioner is vital to keep the operations of the company going during this twilight period, do you as liquidator think there's scope to argue that payments of their fees during this period could be validated by our courts on the basis that their services are necessary to keep the company afloat and ultimately beneficial towards the general body of creditors?
Thanks again, Lucinda. If you consider the commentary of Blackman, he certainly raises this real issue, which is keeping the company going and what is valid and what is not valid. He does, though, also talk about the practitioner's fees being paid during this period, not for a period that might have been prior to that. And so maybe there's a distinction there. But I certainly think, I mean, we sympathize with Chris's position where he's got a mine and he's got those type of costs. But at the same time, the court has that discretion to either declare it void or to declare it valid. I've never seen payments made to security guards and insurance, by example, or even salaries during this period, being declared void, because they are ordinary course costs which would ordinarily be incurred by the company to keep afloat. I agree with Chris. I think that there is a bit of a stigma with business rescue practitioners' fees that they always get maybe unfairly challenged. But I think the distinction in this matter is if you look at the timeline where a business a liquidation application had already been brought and then had been opposed, and it wasn't an insignificant fee that was paid. It was paid very shortly after the issue of the business rescue practitioner's application, and I think we can just be careful of trying to interpret this particular judgment against all practitioners' fees that may be paid in the ordinary course. I certainly think, and I've said this to Chris on other occasions, if a business rescue practitioner is not able to pay their own fees on a monthly basis or ongoing basis, that certainly questions the viability of the company as a whole. And it looks like this is a substantial amount of money. It's not a few hours that would have been spent by the practitioners in the accumulation of that amount. And I think that is distinguishable in this matter. It's quite a significant amount, and it was the timing of the payment, I think, which probably rendered to be unauthorized and void in this situation.
Thanks, Richard. And Chris, and finally, just from your side, should this matter be referred to the SEA on appeal? Do you want to maybe venture a guess as to what the outcome of the appeal would be?
Thanks, Lucinda. I think, well, first of all, I suppose the question is whether there would be grounds for leave to appeal. I would suspect that the judge would probably grant leave to appeal. Whether the appeal would be successful, I think, would be specifically around what is being referred to the court for consideration. And for me, that would again be this issue of the concursus creditorum and whether that does backdate to the deemed date or whether it's actually claims to be determined as at the date of liquidation. I know that that's not the only consideration for whether transactions would be voidable or unlawful, but I think that would go a long way for the SEA just to clarify that in particular, because it would make not only the practitioners' lives a bit more clear, it would also make the lives of the liquidators a bit easier, who now have a duty on the back of this type of judgment to investigate or to try and set aside transactions which they may themselves not believe are necessary to be set aside, especially if they think they are in the ordinary course of business. So to answer your question directly, I think the matter, it would be nice for it to be referred to the SCA. Whether the quantum involved here would actually see the respondents referring it or not, I doubt. But I think it's something that does need to be clarified, especially for purposes of moving forward. And one must always remember, from my perspective, that when developing the law on these issues, it's important that there's clarity on it. There's nothing worse than having situations where you have unscrupulous practitioners, for example, finding alternative ways of paying themselves simply because they're trying to get around what the law is. And I think that has to be avoided. And certainly it isn't the burden of the court, but I think having absolute clarity from the SCA on this would be great for both liquidators and for business rescue practitioners.
Thanks, Chris. No, I agree with you there. So thank you, Richard. Thank you, Chris, for your interesting and very insightful takes and comments on the Mazars judgment. I think you left us and our listeners with a lot to think about. Thank you also for everybody that joined us today to listen to the podcast, and we look forward to you joining us for our next edition of our podcast series, which will be coming to you soon. Goodbye and have a good day.